Hi guys. So we're gonna continue reading The Fault in Our Stars, trying to finish it up as much as I can in these next couple recordings. We're currently on chapter 20, so here we go. One of the less bullshitty conventions of the cancer kid genre is the Last Good Day convention, wherein the victim of cancer finds herself with some unexpected hours when it seems like the inexorable decline is suddenly plateaued. When the pain is for a moment bearable. The problem, of course, is that there's no way of knowing that your last good day is your last good day. At the time, it's just another good day. I'd taken a day off from visiting Augustus because I was feeling a bit unwell myself. Nothing specific, just tired. It had been a lazy day, and when Augustus called just after 5 p.m., I was already attached to the BiPAP, which we dragged out to the living room so I could watch TV with Mom and Dad. "Hi, Augustus," I said. He answered in the voice I'd fallen for. "Good evening, Hazel Grace. Do you suppose you could find your way to the literal heart of Jesus around 8 p.m?" "Yes." "Excellent. Also, if it's not too much trouble, please prepare a eulogy." I said. "I love you," he said. "And I you," I answered. Then the phone clicked off. I said, "I have to go to support group at 8 tonight. Emergency session." My mom muted the TV. "Is everything okay?" I looked at her for a second, my eyebrows raised. I assume that's a rhetorical question. But why would there... "Because Gus needs me for some reason. It's fine, I can drive." I fiddled with the BiPAP so Mom would help me take it off, but she didn't. "Hazel," she said, "your dad and I feel like we hardly even see you anymore." "Particularly those of us who work all week," Dad said. "He needs me," I said, finally unfastening the BiPAP myself. "We need you too, kiddo," my dad said. He took hold of my wrist like I was a 2-year-old about to dart out into the street and gripped it. "Well, get a terminal disease, Dad, and then I'll stay home more." "Hazel," my mom said. "You were the one who didn't want me to be a homebody," I said to her. Dad was still clutching my arm. "And now you want him to go ahead and die, so I'll be back here chained to this place? Letting you take care of me like I always used to? But I don't need it, Mom. I don't need you like I used to. You're the one who needs to get a life." "Hazel," Dad said, squeezing harder, "apologize to your mother." I was tugging at my arm, but he wouldn't let go, and I couldn't get my cannula on with only one hand. I was infuriated. All I wanted was an old-fashioned teenager walkout, where I stomp out of the room and slam the door to my bedroom and turn up the hectic glow and furiously write a eulogy. But I couldn't because I couldn't freaking breathe. "The cannula," I whined. "I need it." My dad immediately let go and rushed to connect me to the oxygen. I could see the guilt in his eyes, but he was still angry. "Hazel, apologize to your mother." "Fine, I'm sorry. Just please let me do this." They didn't say anything. Mom just sat there with her arms folded, not even looking at me. After a while, I got up and went to my room to write about Augustus. Both Mom and Dad tried a few times to knock on the door or whatever, but I just told them I was doing something important. It took me forever to figure out what I wanted to say, and even then I wasn't very happy with it. Before I technically finished, I noticed it was 7:40, which meant that I would be late if I didn't change. So, in the end, I wore baby blue cotton pajamas, flip-flops, and Gus's butler shirt. I walked out of the room and tried to go right past them, but my dad said, "You can't leave the house without permission." Oh, my God, Dad. He wanted me to write him a eulogy, okay? I'll be home every freaking night, starting any day now, okay? And that finally shut them up. It took the entire drive to calm down my parents. I pulled up around the back of the church and parked in the semi-circular driveway behind Augustus's car. The back door to the church was held open by a fist-sized rock. Inside, I contemplated taking the stairs, but decided to wait for the ancient creaking elevator. And when the elevator doors unscrolled, I was in the support group room, the chairs arranged in the same circle. But now I only saw Gus in a wheelchair. Ghoulishly thin. He was facing me from the center of the circle. He had been waiting for the elevator doors to open. "Hazel Grace," he said, "you look ravishing." "I know, right?" I heard a shuffling in the dark corner of the room. Isaac stood behind a little wooden lectern, clinging to it. "You want to sit?" I asked him. "No, I'm about to eulogize. You're late." "I'm... what?" Gus gestured for me to sit. I pulled a chair into the center of the circle with him as he spun the chair to face Isaac. "I want to attend my funeral," Gus said. "By the way, will you speak at my funeral?" "Of course, yeah," I said, letting my head fall onto his shoulder. I reached across his back and hugged both him and the wheelchair. He winced, so I let go. "Awesome," he said. "I'm hopeful I'll get to attend as a ghost, but just to make sure, I thought I'd, well, not to put you on the spot, but I just thought this afternoon I could arrange a pre-funeral, and I figured since I'm in reasonably good spirits, there's no time like the present." "How did you even get in here?" I asked him. "Would you believe they leave the door open all night?" Gus asked. No, I said. "As well you shouldn't," Gus smiled. "Anyways, I know it's a bit self-aggrandizing." "Hey, you're stealing my eulogy," Isaac said. "My first bit is about how you're a self-aggrandizing bastard." I laughed. "Okay, okay," Gus said, "at your leisure." Isaac cleared his throat. "Augustus Waters was a self-aggrandizing bastard, but we forgive him. We forgive him not because he had a heart as figuratively good as his literal one sucked, or because he knew more about how to hold a cigarette than any non-smoker in history, or because he got 18 years where he should have gotten more." 17, Gus corrected. "I'm assuming you've still got some time, you interrupting bastard." "I'm telling you," Isaac continued, "Augustus Waters talked so much that he'd interrupt you at his own funeral, and he was pretentious. Sweet Jesus Christ, that kid never took a piss without pondering the abundant metaphorical resonances of human waste production. And he was vain. I do not believe I've ever met a more physically attractive person who was more acutely aware of his own physical attractiveness. But I will say this. When the scientists of the future show up at my house with robot eyes, and they tell me to try them on, I will tell the scientists to screw off, because I do not want to see a world without him." I was kind of crying by then. "And then, having made my rhetorical point, I will put my robot eyes on, because, I mean, with robot eyes you can probably see through girls' shirts and stuff. Augustus, my friend, Godspeed." Augustus nodded for a while, his lips pursed, and then gave Isaac a thumbs up. After he'd recovered his composure, he added, I would cut the bit about seeing through girls' shirts." Isaac was clinging to the lectern. He started to cry. He pressed his forehead down to the podium, and I watched his shoulders shake. And then finally he said, "God damn it, Augustus, editing your own eulogy." "Don't swear in the literal heart of Jesus," Gus said. "God damn it," Isaac said again. He raised his head and swallowed. "Hazel, can I get a hand here?" I'd forgotten he couldn't make his own way back to the circle. I got up, placed his hand on my arm, and walked him slowly back down to the chair next to Gus, where I'd been sitting. Then I walked to the podium and unfolded the piece of paper on which I printed my eulogy. "Hi, my name is Hazel. Augustus Waters was the great star-crossed love of my life. Ours was an epic love story, and I won't be able to get more than a sentence into it without disappearing into a puddle of tears." Gus knew. Gus knows. "I will not tell you our love story because, like all real love stories, it will die with us, as it should. I'd hoped that he'd be eulogizing me, because there's no one I'd rather have..." I started crying. "Okay, how not to cry? How am I? Okay. Okay." I took a few breaths and went back to the page. "I can't talk about our love story, so I will talk about math. I am not a mathematician, but I know this. There are infinite numbers between 1 and 0. There's 0.1 and 0.12 and 0.112 and an infinite collection of others. Of course, there's a bigger infinite set of numbers between 0 and 2. Or between 0 and a million. Some infinities are bigger than other infinities. A writer we used to like taught us that. There are days, many of them, when I resent the size of my unbounded set. I want more numbers than I'm likely to get. And God, I want more numbers for Augustus Waters than he got. But Gus, my love, I cannot tell you how thankful I am for a little infinity. I wouldn't trade it for the world. You gave me a forever within the numbered days, and I'm grateful. Chapter 21. Augustus Waters died 8 days after his pre-funeral, at Memorial in the ICU, when the cancer, which was made of him, finally stopped his heart, which was also made of him. He was with his mom and dad and sisters. His mom called me at 3:30 in the morning. I'd known, of course, that he was going. I'd talked to his dad before going to bed, and he told me it could be tonight. But still, when I grabbed the phone from the bedside table and saw Gus's mom on the caller ID, everything inside of me collapsed. She was just crying on the other end of the line, and she told me she was sorry, and I said I was sorry too. And she told me that he was unconscious for a couple hours before he died. My parents came in then, looking expectant, and I nodded and they fell into each other, feeling, I'm sure, the terror that would in time come for them directly. I called Isaac, who cursed life and the universe and God himself, and who said, where are the goddamn trophies to break when you need them? And then I realized there was no one else to call, which was the saddest thing. The only person I really wanted to talk to about Augustus Waters' death was Augustus Waters. My parents stayed in my room forever until it was morning, and Dad finally said, do you want to be alone? And I nodded. And Mom said, we'll be right outside the door. Me thinking, I don't doubt it. It was unbearable. The whole thing. Every second worse than the last. I just kept thinking about calling him, wondering what would happen, if anyone would answer. In the last weeks, we've been reduced to spending our time together in recollection. But that was not nothing. The pleasure of remembering had been taken from me, because there was no longer anyone to remember with. It felt like losing your co-rememberer meant losing the memory itself. As if the things we'd done were less real and important than they had been hours before. When you go into the ER, one of the first things they ask you to do is rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10. And from there they decide which drugs to use and how quickly to use them. I had been asked this question hundreds of times over the years. And I remember once early on when I couldn't get my breath and it felt like my chest was on fire. Flames licking the inside of my ribs, fighting for a way to burn out the rest of my body. My parents took me to the ER. A nurse asked me about the pain, and I couldn't even speak, so I held up 9 fingers. Later, after they'd given me something, the nurse came in, and she was kind of stroking my head while she took my blood pressure, and she said, you know how I know you're a fighter? Because you called a 10 a 9. But that wasn't quite right. I called it a 9 because I was saving my 10. And here it was, the great and terrible 10, slamming me again and again as I lay still and alone in my bed, staring at the ceiling. The waves tossing me against the rocks and then pulling back out to sea so they could launch me again into the jagged face of the cliff, leaving me floating face up on the water, undrowned. Finally, I did call him. His phone rang 5 times and then went to voicemail. You've reached the voicemail of Augustus Waters, he said. The voice I'd fallen for. Leave a message, it beeped. The dead air on the line was so eerie. I just wanted to go back to that secret post-terrestrial third space with him that we'd visited when we talked on the phone. I waited for that feeling, but it never came. The dead air on the line was no comfort, and finally I hung up. I got my laptop out from under the bed, and I fired it up and went onto his wall page, where already the condolences were flooding in. The most recent one said, I love you, bro. See you on the other side. Written by someone I'd never even heard of. In fact, almost all the wall posts, which arrived nearly as fast as I could read them, were written by people I had never met, and whom he'd never spoken about. People who were extolling his various virtues now that he was dead, even though I knew for a fact they hadn't seen him in months and had made no effort to visit him. I wondered if my wall would look like this if I died, or if I'd been out of school and life long enough to escape widespread memorialization. I kept reading. I miss you already, bro. I love you, Augustus. God bless and keep you. You'll live forever in our hearts, big man. That particularly galled me, because it implied the immortality of those left behind. You will live forever in my memory, because I will live forever. I am your god now, dead boy, I own you. Thinking you won't die is yet another side effect of dying. You were always such a good friend. I'm sorry I didn't see more of you after you left school, bro. I bet you're already playing ball in heaven. I imagine the Augustus Waters analysis of that comment. If I'm playing basketball in heaven, does that imply a physical location of a heaven containing physical basketballs? Who makes the basketballs in question? Are there less fortunate souls in heaven who work in a celestial basketball factory so that I can play? Or did an omnipotent god create the basketballs out of the vacuum of space? Is this heaven some kind of unobservable universe where the laws of physics don't apply? And if so, why in the hell would I be playing basketball when I could be flying, or reading, or looking at beautiful people, or something else I actually enjoy? It's almost as if the way you imagine my dead self says more about you than it says about either the person I was or whatever I am now. His parents called around noon to say the funeral would be in 5 days, on Saturday. I pictured a church packed with people who thought he liked basketball, and I wanted to puke. But I knew I had to go, since I was speaking in everything. When I hung up, I went back to reading his wall. Just heard that Gus Waters died after a lengthy battle with cancer. Rest in peace, buddy. I knew these people were genuinely sad, and that I wasn't really mad at them. I was mad at the universe. Even though it infuriated me. You get all these friends just when you don't need friends anymore. I wrote a reply to his comment. We live in a universe devoted to the creation and eradication of awareness. Augustus Waters did not die after a lengthy battle with cancer. He died after a lengthy battle with human consciousness, a victim, as you will be, of the universe's need to make and unmake all that is possible. I posted it and waited for someone to reply, refreshing over and over again. Nothing. My comment got lost in the blizzard of new posts. Everyone was going to miss him so much. Everyone was praying for his family. I remembered Van Houten's letter. Writing does not resurrect. It buries. And after a while, I went into the living room to sit with my parents and watch TV. I couldn't tell you what the show was, but at some point my mom said, "Hazel, what can we do for you?" And I just shook my head. I started crying again. "What can we do?" Mom asked again. I shrugged, but she kept asking, as if there were somewhere she could go, something she could do. Until finally, I just kind of crawled across the couch into her lap. And my dad came over and held my legs really tight, and I wrapped my arms all the way around my mom's middle, and they held on to me for hours while the tide rolled in. Chapter 22. When we first got there, I sat in the back of the visitation room, a little room of exposed stone walls off to the side of the sanctuary in the literal heart of Jesus Church. There were maybe 80 chairs set up in the room, and it was 2/3 full, but felt 1/3 empty. For a while, I just sort of watched people walk up to the coffin, which was on some kind of cart covered in a purple tablecloth. All these people I'd never seen before would kneel down next to him or stand over him, look at him for a while, maybe crying, maybe saying something, and then all of them would touch the coffin instead of touching him, because nobody wants to touch the dead. Gus's mom and dad were standing next to the coffin, hugging everyone as they passed by, but when they noticed me, they smiled and shuffled over. I got up and hugged first his dad and then his mom, who held on to me too tight, like Gus used to, squeezing my shoulder blades. They both looked so old, their eye sockets hollowed, the skin sagging from their exhausted faces. They had reached the end of a hurtling sprint, too. "He loved you so much," Gus's mom said. "He really did. It wasn't puppy love or anything," she added, as if I didn't know that. "He loved you so much, too," I said quietly. It's hard to explain, but talking to them felt like stabbing and being stabbed. I'm sorry, I said. And then his parents were talking to my parents, the conversation all nodding and tight lips. I looked up at the casket and saw it unattended, so I decided to walk up there. I pulled the oxygen tube from my nostrils and raised the tube over my head, handing it to my dad. I wanted it to just be me and him. I grabbed my little clutch and walked up the makeshift aisle between the rows of chairs. The walk felt long, but I kept telling my lungs to shut up, that they were strong. They could do this. I could see him as I approached. His hair was parted neatly on the left side in a way that he would have found absolutely horrifying, and his face was plastized. But he was still Gus. My lanky, beautiful Gus. I wanted to wear the little black dress I'd bought for my 15th birthday party, my death dress, but I didn't fit into it anymore. So I wore a plain black dress, knee length. Augustus wore the same thin lapelled suit he'd worn to Orangi. As I knelt, I realized they'd closed his eyes. Of course they had. And that I would never see again his blue eyes. I love you, present tense, I whispered. And then put my hand on the middle of his chest and said, It's okay, Gus. It's okay, it is. It's okay. You hear me? I had, and have, absolutely no confidence that he could hear me. I leaned forward and kissed his cheek. Okay, I said. Okay. I suddenly felt conscious that there were all these people watching us. That the last time so many people saw us kiss, we were in the Anne Frank house. But there was, properly speaking, no one left to watch. Only me, not us. I snapped open the clutch, reached in and pulled out a hard pack of Camel Lights. In a quick motion, I hoped no one would notice, I snuck them into the space between the side and the coffin's plush silver lining. You can light these, I whispered to him. I won't mind. While I was talking to him, Mom and Dad had moved up to the second row of my tank, so I didn't have a long walk back. Dad handed me a tissue as I sat down, so I blew my nose, threaded the tubes around my ears, and put the nubbins back in. I thought we'd go to the proper sanctuary for the real funeral, but it all happened in that little side room, the literal hand of Jesus. I guess the part of the cross he'd been nailed to. A minister walked up and stood behind the coffin, almost like the coffin was a pulpit or something, and talked a little bit about how Augustus had a courageous battle, and how his heroism in the face of illness was an inspiration to us all. And I was already starting to get a little pissed off at the minister when he said, in heaven, Augustus will finally be healed and whole, implying that he had been less whole than other people due to his leglessness, and I kind of could not repress my sigh of disgust. My dad grabbed me above the knee and cut me a disapproving look, but from the row behind me, someone muttered almost inaudibly near my ear, What a load of horse crap, eh, kid? I spun around. Peter Van Houten wore a white linen suit, tailored to account for his rotundity, a powder blue dress shirt, and a green tie. He looked like he was dressed for a colonial occupation of Panama, not a funeral. The minister said, Let us pray, but as everyone else bowed their head, I could only stare at slack-jawed at the sight of Peter Van Houten. After a moment, he whispered, We got a fake pray. And he bowed his head. I tried to forget about him and just pray for Augustus. I made a point of listening to the minister and not looking back. The minister called up Isaac, who was much more serious now than he had been at the pre-funeral. Augustus Waters was the mayor of the secret city of Cancervania, and he is not replaceable, Isaac began. Other people will tell you that it's funny stories about Augustus, because he was a funny guy. Funny stories about Gus, because he was a funny guy. But let me tell you a serious one. A day after I got my eye cut out, Gus showed up at the hospital. I was blind and heartbroken and didn't want to have to do anything, and Gus bursted into my room and shouted, I have wonderful news. And I was like, I don't really want to hear wonderful news right now. And Gus said, This is wonderful news you want to hear. And I asked him, Fine, what is it? And he said, You're going to live a good and long life filled with great and terrible moments that you cannot even imagine yet. Isaac couldn't go on. Or maybe that's all he had written. after a high school friend told some stories about how Gus's considerable basketball talents and his many qualities as a teammate, the minister said, "Well, now we'll hear a few special words from Gus's special friend, Hazel." "Special friend?" There were some titters in the audience, so I figured it was safe for me to start out by saying to the minister, "I was his girlfriend." That got a laugh. Then I began reading from the eulogy I'd written. There's a great quote in Gus's house, one that both he and I found very comforting. "Without pain, we couldn't know joy." I went on spouting bullshit encouragements as Gus's parents, arm in arm, hugged each other and nodded at every word. Funerals, I had decided, are for the living. After his sister Julie spoke, the service ended with a prayer about Gus's union with God, and I thought back to what he'd told me about Arangi, that he didn't believe in mansions and harps, but he did believe in capital S something. And so I tried to imagine him capital S somewhere as we prayed. But even then, I could not quite convince myself that he and I would be together again. I already knew too many dead people. I knew that time would now pass for me differently than it would for him. That I, like everyone in that room, would go on accumulating loves and losses while he would not. And for me, that was the final and truly unbearable tragedy. Like all the dead, he'd once and for all been demoted from haunted to haunter. And then one of Gus's brother-in-laws brought up a boombox, and they played this song Gus had picked out. A sad and quiet song by the Hectic Glow called The New Partner. I just wanted to go home, honestly. I didn't know hardly any of these people, and I felt Peter Van Houten's little eyes boring into my exposed shoulder blades. But after the song was over, everyone had come up to me and told me that I had spoken beautifully, and that it was a lovely service, which was a lie. It was a funeral. It looked like any other funeral. His pallbearers, cousins, his dad and uncle, friends I'd never seen, came and got him, and they all started walking towards the hearse. When Mom and Dad and I got in the car, I said, "I don't want to go, I'm tired." "Hazel," Mom said. "Mom, there won't be a place to sit, and it'll last forever, and I'm exhausted." "Hazel, we have to go for Mr. and Mrs. Waters," Mom said. "Just," I said, I felt so little in the backseat for some reason. I kind of wanted to be little. I wanted to be, like, 6 years old or something. "Fine," I said. I just stared out the window a while. I really didn't want to go. I didn't want him to see them. I didn't want to see them lower him into the ground in the spot he'd picked out with his dad. And I didn't want to see his parents sink to their knees in the dew-wet grass and moan in pain. And I didn't want to see Peter Van Houten's alcoholic belly stretched across his linen jacket. And I didn't want to cry in front of a bunch of people. I didn't want to toss a handful of dirt onto his grave. I didn't want my parents to have to stand there beneath the clear blue sky in its certain slant of afternoon light, thinking about their day and their kid, and my plot and my casket and my dirt. But I did these things. I did all of them and worse, because Mom and Dad felt we should. And after it was over, Van Houten walked up to me and put a fat hand on my shoulder and said, "Could I hitch a ride?" Left my rental at the bottom of the hill. I shrugged and he opened the door to the back seat right as my dad unlocked the car. Inside, he leaned between the front seats and said, "Peter Van Houten, novelist and semi-professional disappointer." My parents introduced themselves. He shook their hands. I was pretty surprised that Van Houten had flown halfway across the world to attend a funeral. "How did you even..." I started, but he cut me off. "I used the infernal internet of yours to follow the Indianapolis obituary notices." He reached into his linen suit and produced a fifth of whiskey. "And you just, like, bought a ticket and..." He interrupted again while unscrewing the cap. "It was $15,000 for a first-class ticket, but I'm sufficiently capitalized to indulge such whims, and the drinks are free on the flight. If you're ambitious, you can almost break even." Van Houten took a swig of the whiskey and then leaned forward to offer it to my dad, who said, "No thanks." Then Van Houten nodded the bottle towards me, and I grabbed it. "Hazel," my mom said, but I unscrewed the cap and sipped. It made my stomach feel like my lungs. I handed the bottle back to Van Houten, who took a long slug from it, and then said, "So, omnis cellula is cellula." "Huh?" "Your boy Waters and I corresponded a bit, and in his last..." "Wait, you read your fan mail now?" No, he sent it to my house, not through my publisher. And I'd call him hardly a fan. He despised me. But at any rate, he was quite insistent that I'd absolve from my misbehavior if I attended his funeral and told you what became of Anna's mother. So here I am, and there's your answer. Omnis cellula e cellula. What? I asked him again. Omnis cellula e cellula, he said again. All cells come from cells. Every cell is born of a previous cell, which was born of a previous cell. Life comes from life. Life begets life begets life. Begets life begets life. We reached the bottom of the hill. Okay, yeah, I said. I was in no mood for this. Peter Van Houten would not hijack his funeral. I wouldn't allow it. Thanks, I said. Well, I guess we're at the bottom of the hill. You don't want an explanation? He asked. No, I said, I'm good. I think you're a pathetic alcoholic who says fancy things to get attention like a really precocious 11-year-old, and I feel super bad for you. But yeah, no, you're not the guy who wrote an Imperial Affliction anymore, so you couldn't sequel it even if you wanted to. Thanks, though. Have a good life. But thanks for the booze, I said. Now get out of the car. He looked scolded. Dad had stopped the car, and we just idled there below Gress's grave for a minute until Van Houten opened the door and finally, silent, left. As we drove away, I watched through the back window as he took a drink and raised the bottle in my direction, as if toasting me. His eyes looked so sad. I felt kind of bad for him, to be honest. We finally got home around 6, and I was exhausted. I just wanted to sleep, but Mom made me some cheesy pasta, although she had at least allowed me to eat in bed. I slept with the BiPAP for a couple hours. Waking up was horrible, because for a disoriented moment, I felt like everything was fine, and then it crushed me anew. Mom took me off the BiPAP. I tethered myself to a portable tank and stumbled into my bathroom to brush my teeth. Appraising myself in the mirror as I brushed my teeth, I kept thinking how there were two kinds of adults. There were Peter Van Houtens, miserable creatures who scoured the earth in search of something to hurt. And then there were people like my parents, who walked around zombotically, doing whatever they had to do to keep walking around. Neither of these features struck me as particularly desirable. It seemed to me that I'd already seen everything pure and good in the world, and I was beginning to suspect that even if death didn't get in the way, the kind of love that Augustus and I share could never last. So dawn goes down today, the poet wrote. Nothing gold can stay. Someone knocked on the bathroom door. Occupata, I said. Hazel, my dad said, can I come in? I didn't answer, but after a while I unlocked the door. I sat down on the closed toilet seat. Why did breathing have to be such work? Dad knelt down next to me. He grabbed my head and pulled it into his collarbone, and he said, I'm sorry Gus died. I felt kind of suffocated by his t-shirt, but it felt good to be held so hard, pressed into the comfortable smell of my dad. It was almost like he was angry or something, and I liked that, because I was angry too. It's total bullshit, he said, the whole thing. 80% survival rate and he's in the 20%. Bullshit. He was such a bright kid. It's bullshit. I hate it. But it sure was a privilege to love him, huh? I nodded into his shirt. Gives you an idea how I feel about you, he said. My old man. He always knew just what to say. Okay. I think that's going to be my last one for right now, and then I think we'll have one more. And then that should be the end of the book. Thank you guys so much for listening, if you did listen to this. Yeah. Have a really good night. Bye.